Hello. Again, I'm Philip Oxhorn, the director of the Institute for the Study of International Development and professor of political science. Thank you for coming here on this very cold morning. We had a very excellent first day, and we're going to be off to a great start on the second day. I'm going to pass the podium over to my friend and colleague, Professor Catherine Lewin, political science, who will introduce the first panel.
Thank you all very much for coming, and thank you, Phil, for organizing this panel and to all the others who really helped to make it work. And I want to thank the panelists who were here yesterday also. That was a great start to this conference on truth and reconciliation, or should I say, whose truth and what kind of reconciliation. So today we are going to deal with the major philosophical task that these questions pose. And unfortunately, we originally had a speaker coming from Illinois, Colleen Murphy, who I think has written the best book on political reconciliation, called A Moral Theory of Political Reconciliation, published by Cambridge in 2010. So unfortunately, thank you, Snowstorm, she did not make it to the conference. And so I'm going to have to channel her a little bit in my opening remarks. I should also plug her next book, which is coming out, The Conceptual Foundations of Transitional Justice. So please look for her work, Colleen Murphy. And I apologize that on her behalf that she cannot join us today. All right, so the main question that I think our panel is going to try to discuss today is a foundational one, which is, what is reconciliation? And also, why is it morally desirable or justified as a political project? Now, in the aftermath of all sorts of conflict, civil, international, some have hailed reconciliation as a great and perhaps even the greatest moral and political value. When you think about the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya in late 2012, the United Nations and the United Nations Development Program sponsored a two-day conference called Truth and Reconciliation in Libya, The Way Forward. Scholars today have responded to the conflict in the Ukraine by calling for inclusive policies towards the linguistic, ethnic, and cultural groups of Ukraine in order to increase mutual trust and facilitate national reconciliation. That is actually written by my colleagues Juliet Johnson and Maria Popova. Reconciliation, of course, is also recognized in international relations, so that in the aftermath of World War I, the architects of the 1919 Versailles Treaty process were concerned that the treaty provide the basis upon which the peoples of Europe can live together in friendship and equality. Now, at the same time that reconciliation seems to be such a pressing, urgent, and obvious need, the concept of reconciliation has proved so elusive, so confusing, and so objectionable that some have urged abandoning it entirely. In fact, some of these people include the co-editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Transitional Justice, Harvey Weinstein, who wrote an editorial note lamenting the illusion of reconciliation. So conceptually, there's confusion about what actually characterizes the end or achievement of reconciliation. Is it just the end of violence, or a more robust form of social solidarity, even friendship among previously antagonistic groups? Is it the end of oppression and persecution only, or is it a more secure model of social inclusion and integration? Is it achieved with the institutionalization of formal political equality and rights? Or does it require a more demanding form of egalitarianism, a more egalitarian ethos? So that's questions related to what exactly is the end of reconciliation, and how some people might describe thick or thin is it. Another open question relates to who or what is being reconciled. So when we talk about reconciliation, who are the agents and subjects of reconciliation? Do we mean one-to-one interpersonal reconciliation between individuals, between victims and perpetrators, for example? Or do we mean something more communal, as in members of a community who were formerly opposed or opposing sides of a conflict? Do we mean reconciliation between a state and the people or its community? So do we mean it in a more institutional sense? There are also questions that abound to do with the moral content of reconciliation, as well as its psychosocial indicators. What does that mean? Well, does reconciliation involve forgiveness or require it? Does it require forgiveness or does it require reparations? Does reconciliation mean healing or closure? And who is actually being healed? Is it the individual, the family, the community, or the state? So this panel aims to address the philosophical debates about what is reconciliation or what it might be and why it is justified. Why might it not be justified? Well, one concern is that reconciliation, understood in certain forms, may demand too much from victims. Requiring people who have suffered harms and wrongs to let go of their resentment or hatred may seem excessively demanding and therefore an infeasible task. As a survivor of the Rwandan genocide put it, "I don't understand the word reconciliation. I can't reconcile with people, even if they are in prison. If a person comes to ask my forgiveness, I will forgive him after he has resuscitated the members of my family that he killed." So from a psychological point of view, not even retribution can guarantee reconciliation. From a moral point of view, requiring people to change their feelings of resentment and hatred may constitute a morally objectionable requirement because it compounds victim suffering or adds to their burdens by blaming them and making them responsible for holding certain reactive attitudes towards their experiences of victimization. So in addition to infeasibility, it is morally problematic to impose on individuals to reconcile with former aggressors or perpetrators or to get over the wrongs they have suffered. As Colleen Murphy has argued, I quote, "To take the overcoming of resentment as the primary goal of policies of political reconciliation problematically implies that the primary change to relationships should occur among the innocent." Another related worry about reconciliation has to do with how it's applied then to intergroup relations. So often we take this individual model and we try to apply it to a group. For example, the Handbook on Reconciliation After Violent Conflict presents its basic definition of reconciliation as a process through which society moves from a divided past to a shared future. Now, multiple estrangements make conflict and disagreement endemic to post-conflict settings. The dream of reconciliation implies a kind of social unity that may be unrealistic, leading to worries that the project of reconciliation comprises myths and illusions. The goal of intergroup reconciliation may also be confused when reconciliation is defined as an overarching process, which includes the search for truth, justice, forgiveness, healing, and so on, which unhelpfully conflates processes of political reconciliation with individual therapeutic models of healing and forgiveness. Furthermore, from a moral perspective, all too often in historical and contemporary practice, intergroup reconciliation has been another philosopher, Michael Hardiman, has termed a code word for impunity and amnesia, placing a burden of forgiveness on victims while letting torturers and killers escape justice. If reconciliation entails accommodating evil, it may be better morally to remain unreconciled. Indeed, it is difficult to understand how reconciliation can be a moral or political value if it requires imposing, first of all, undue moral and psychological burdens on individuals, especially victims, to let go of their resentments, or if it imposes a striving for an ego-destroying, conflict-destroying form of social unity, and if it requires us to accommodate evil. So the challenge, then, is to ask whether reconciliation can be progressive versus reactionary, whether it can repudiate evil rather than accommodate it, whether it can be based on an acceptable form of social unity. That is the challenge of that I posed to our panelists this morning, who I will now introduce. So first we will have David Deisenhaus. David Deisenhaus is a professor of law and philosophy at the University of Toronto and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. And in 2014-15, he will be the Arthur Goodhart Visiting Professor in Legal Science in Cambridge. Professor Deisenhaus is the author of several books, including Hard Cases in Wicked Legal Systems, South African Law in the Perspective of Legal Philosophy, a book which is now in its second edition. Also a book on legality and legitimacy, Carl Schmitt, Hans Kelsen, and Hermann Heller in Weimar. And also the book Judging the Judges, Judging Ourselves, Truth, Reconciliation, and the Apartheid Legal Order. After David Deisenhaus, we will be followed by Glenda Mazaroba. Glenda Mazaroba is a political scientist specializing in transitional justice. She received her PhD degree from the University of Sao Paulo in 2008 with a dissertation titled The Price of Forgetting, The Reparations Paid to the Victims of the Military Regime, a comparison between Brazil, Argentina, and Chile. Dr. Mazaroba is the author of Settling Accounts with the Future, The Amnesty Law and the Consequences, a Brazilian case study. And since 2012, she has been working as a UNDP consultant with the Brazilian Truth Commission. Thank you very much. David?
Well, thank you very much for having me here. And I do apologize for my absence last night. I could only leave Toronto after teaching a class which ended at 6, so I got here rather late last night. So I'm going to start with a qualification, and that is I've done a fair amount of work on Truth and Reconciliation Commissions and also on the topic of transitional justice. But all of my work, and I think you can probably tell this from my accent, I'm not Canadian originally, I come from South Africa, all of my work on TRCs and transitional justice is framed by the South African experience. It's not a bad frame to have, just because the South African TRC did become rather central to the way that people think about transitional justice and the topics for this conference in general. But still, it is a frame, and I did want to mention that I'm not that sure that the South African experience has much relevance when it comes to the Canadian context, and I'm going to say a little bit about that in my presentation. So a common way of understanding the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that it was born in a political compromise between, on the one hand, the political elites who had ruled South Africa and the African National Congress. And what this Truth and Reconciliation Commission did was that it offered amnesty to perpetrators of gross human rights abuses in return for general support of the transitional process. But the idea of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that it wasn't a mere political compromise. It was a principled compromise. Why? It did not offer blanket amnesty. Perpetrators of gross human rights abuses, and it's probably important to keep in mind that these abuses were against the law of apartheid South Africa. So people, perpetrators were regarded as perpetrators only if they did things that were in fact against the law of the time. They did not get blanket amnesty, rather they had to apply to a committee, make a full confession of what they'd done, show that it was done with a political motive, and also that what they had done was proportional in some way to the end that they were trying to achieve. So one understanding of the amnesty process in South Africa is that it did involve elements of retributive justice. First of all, people did have to fess up, and once they had fessed up, that involved taking a certain kind of responsibility, subjecting themselves to moral condemnation. But moreover, if one failed to get amnesty from the commission, or when was implicated by someone who did confess but had failed to go at all before this committee, then it was possible that one would be brought before a court and tried in a criminal trial for one's deeds during the apartheid regime. So that was another element of retributive justice that was present during the South African process. that's what I want to say in regard to the perpetrators. As many of you will know, there was also the Committee on Human Rights Violations. And the Committee on Human Rights Violations heard testimony from those who had been subjected to the gross human rights abuses. And this was considered important because, at least in principle, anyone who had suffered such an abuse could go before the committee and give a full account of what had happened to them. And so they weren't instrumentalized in the way that witnesses are often instrumentalized in a criminal trial, where the court only wants to hear as much as is necessary to assess whether the accused person is guilty or not. Moreover, the people who did register their human rights abuses before the committee were entitled to then get reparations from a separate committee, which was put in charge of making reparations to those who had suffered gross human rights abuses. Now, I spoke a few moments ago about the possibility that one could understand the work of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission in terms of some elements of retributive justice being present in the process. But this wasn't actually the main perception that was offered by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, and in particular by the person who was in charge of the whole show, that is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Because the Truth and Reconciliation Commission claimed, during its work and also in the report, that it was doing a different kind of justice from retributive justice, and actually a superior kind of justice in the context. And what it was doing was called restorative justice. So there was an overarching ideal of restorative justice. The idea is that one brings the perpetrators and the victims together in one community, the perpetrators confess, the witnesses forgive, and this is superior to retributive justice because it leads to the formation of a community and people can achieve genuine reconciliation with each other. And this served as a model, so the claim went, for all South Africans. It was a kind of generalized institutional form of doing what Mandela had managed to do through his personal example of forgiving white South Africans for what they'd done in order to pave the way forward to a juster society. I'm skeptical of the idea of restorative justice, at least in the South African context, and the idea of reconciliation that travels with it, for very much the reasons that Catherine has already outlined. The idea of reconciliation, I think, is highly problematic in a context like the South African one. So if one focuses on the first two letters in the idea of reconciliation, RE, it suggests that there was a community that was fractured and now people have to be brought together again. But as you'll know, in South Africa, and I think one could make the same kind of claim about Canada, there wasn't one community that was fractured and now has to be brought together again. Rather, what happened was that there was a settler community which established a regime over the course of South African history of racist supremacy over other South Africans, and the question for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the general transitional process was if one could at all form a community in the highly unpropitious conditions that were bequeathed to South Africans by the legacy of apartheid and, of course, what had happened before apartheid. And in my view, a much more modest understanding of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission process is probably appropriate, and with it travels a rather more modest understanding of reconciliation. I was going to say something about why one might doubt the claims about restorative justice and reconciliation, but actually I think I will just remind you that Catherine has said pretty well what I wanted to say about that. Worries about asking people to forgive, in a way almost placing a demand on them, which might be an intolerable moral burden. And there are also worries about what happened in regard to the perpetrators, because the perpetrators managed to modify their confessions, I think, to the extent possible and avoid implicating people who were at the highest ranks. And so the people who had given the orders actually went scot-free in South Africa. So what did the Truth and Reconciliation Commission achieve? And I think one has to ask this question against a background of a failure of achievement in South Africa. However well things have gone in South Africa, the legacy of social injustice that was bequeathed to South Africa by the apartheid system is still very much with South Africans. It's still a deeply unjust society, and it's the case that most of the people who suffer from social injustice are black South Africans. So whatever the transition achieved, it did not achieve social justice. So what did it achieve? I think what it achieved is that it educated South Africans about the value of democratic citizenship and of the rule of law. And one has to keep in mind here that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa was a kind of dramatic spectacle during the time that it operated. I think that one of the reasons why the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was so effective is that every night on primetime news, there was a significant clip from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And on Sunday nights, there was at least an hour put together by two excellent journalists recapping the week and commenting on what had happened during the week. So by the time the Truth and Reconciliation Commission finished, but before it issued its report, I think it had already done its work in educating South Africans about the values, as I said before, of democratic citizenship and the rule of law. This is why I think that perhaps the South African experience doesn't have all that much application to the Canadian experience. Because whatever the problems of Canada, at least if one compares Canada to other societies either existing or that have existed, Canada doesn't do badly on as a democracy or as a society that's committed to the rule of law. There are all sorts of other problems, but Canadians, I don't think, need the education that South Africans did in the virtues of democracy and the rule of law. So my claim is not at all one that denies that Canadian society is founded on a deep injustice, an injustice which affects many Canadians to this day, and that reform is badly needed, including institutional reform, in order to remedy this injustice. It's just that the basic framework is in place, perhaps, for achieving these ends, which had to be more or less invented in South Africa in the 1990s. So here I'm going to rely not on work that I've done, but work done by another South African called Jonathan Allen. And Allen has argued that the Committee on Human Rights Violations, so the committee that heard from the victims, drew attention to the evil consequences of apartheid and the official transgressions of the rule of law through the gross human rights abuses, which recall were abuses which were illegal under the law of apartheid. And in drawing attention to these evils and to the fact that they were evils perpetrated against the law, the Human Rights Committee, according to Allen, showed the importance of commitment to the rule of law, and as part of that commitment, the importance of the equality of all those subject to the law. That is, they came to be seen as agents. So let me read a rather lengthy quote from Allen because he puts it better than I can. He says that the justice victims got is different from restorative justice. The kind of justice they got was an opportunity to tell their stories, which demonstrated that they are now admitted to the category of responsible agency from which the predecessor regime attempted to exclude them. It is a form of recognition that acknowledges the historical fact of exclusion from legal recognition and seeks to reverse the imposition of passive status by encouraging victims to act in public by telling their stories. This would be an inappropriate concern in a law court, but it is important as a kind of public ritual of recognition of the moral agency of those previously excluded. It is recognition as acknowledgement and admission, and it is related to justice in an additional way because it acknowledges the injustice of the exclusion that made the specific abuses possible. So this, I think, is the first important contribution of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to the cause of justice in South Africa, justice as recognition. Allen identifies another kind of justice, which he calls justice as ethos. And here he draws attention to the corruption of justice during the apartheid era, where justice was seen as what caters to one group's interests. And his view is, and I think this is right, that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission contributed to South Africans learning that justice is something that transcends the interests of any particular group. Justice is something that is worked out between citizens who see each other as free and equal participants in a political order under the rule of law. Now, I think this is really quite important, at least in the South African context, because it points out that if one's going to talk about reconciliation in that context, one can do without referring to individual reconciliation. There were real examples of individual reconciliation, but as Catherine suggested, and as I've repeated, it's too much to ask of particular individuals that they forgive, but it isn't too much to ask of them that they begin to see themselves as free and equal members of one community, and it's within that idea that one can then begin to work out a better future. And the last thing I want to say is that having the Truth and Reconciliation Commission putting in place the constitutional order in the 1990s with a Bill of Rights and a constitutional court that persists to this day, these were all expensive choices. And there were expensive choices that came at the expense of other choices that could have been made. That is, one could imagine a different transition in which the African National Congress took power and sought to do social justice without spending money on these expensive experiments like a constitution and a TRC. But it does seem to me that it's highly unlikely that in the context of South Africa that social justice would have been done had that route been possible and followed. I think that South Africa is immeasurably better off through having put in place the constitutional structure which makes it possible for South Africans to work out their future together. And that structure, I think, was helped enormously by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. What relevance this has to Canada, as I said before, I really am not sure, but I thought I would offer you some reflections on the topics of reconciliation and justice from the South African perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, David.